The Guardian.
Hi, Nicola Davis here. Before you get started with this edition of Science Weekly, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
Children at play with one of their favourite activities. The water provides plenty of opportunities for learning and fun. As they grow up and take part in activities like these, one of the things that children need to be able to do is represent internally the complexity of their social worlds. This involves not just being able to predict how the world of objects works, but also how other people are likely to react in various situations.
In 1985, a group of autism researchers created one of the field's flagship scientific studies.
And research over the last decade has suggested how this seems to appear quite rapidly and suddenly between the ages of 3 and 4 years.
Featuring two dolls, Sally and Anne, the study explored the psychology of children with autism and questioned whether they had a theory of mind.
Outside of the bounds of the directly perceivable stimulus circumstances and allow for predicting and explaining other people's behaviour in a wide variety of novel ways.
Led by Simon Baron Cohen, now at the University of Cambridge, the study was carried out under the watchful eye of Professor Uta Frith. Over 3 decades later, Uta is still one of the field's most prominent figures. Now an emeritus professor of cognitive development at University College London and chair of the diversity committee at the Royal Society, Uta sat down with me in the studio to talk about the changing attitudes towards autism, her passion for the subject, and women in science.
Fantastic. So, it's very quick if you wanted to check something or reference whatever.
I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
It's a boring life.
With her career spanning almost 5 decades, I wanted to start by asking Uta when it was her fascination with the human mind began. So Uta, growing up, when was it that you first became interested in the inner workings of the human mind?
Yeah, I've been asking myself that question. I've been sort of searching for this. And there was actually one incident, which I wrote about on my blog. I was 7 years old, and I was given a nice little pocket for handkerchief. Can you imagine? That's what people gave children a long, long time ago. And it was a heart-shaped pocket. And one side was red with a little blue heart in the middle. And the other side was blue with a little red heart in the middle. You know, using the same materials to cut out these two things. And I much preferred the blue one with a little red heart in the middle. And it occurred to me that this was really, really strange because the other side, which was, you know, the same colours, I just didn't like it very much. And I puzzled over this. And I think it was the sort of very first beginning of saying, what's going on in the mind? Why do I prefer one thing? Would other people prefer something else? And how can we see a difference between things that, well, I thought then at least weren't actually different? So perhaps this was the beginning, but I was interested in so many things that science was just one of the interests.
You were born in Germany and then came to London, and I think I'm right in saying that you originally studied one of your other interests, the history of art. Is that correct? So how did you end up going on to learn a clinical psychology course? That feels like quite a bit of a turn.
Yes, it wasn't premeditated, I know. I really couldn't decide what I was going to do. I had too many options, perhaps. And it seemed to me so exciting to look at many different subjects. And I think art did interest me a lot. And my father was an artist. And I also tried to look at art in it. Sort of almost scientific context, in a historical context. But when I was at university and I sort of sampled different lectures in Germany, which you could do easily, you know, it's not much of a course structure in those days, I did come across psychology. And what really amazed me there, it wasn't at all what I'd sort of imagined, like stories or, you know, trying to find out about yourself, but it was about stats. It was about how you compared different skills and different people, and you could actually describe this. So I was really hooked because it seemed to me, well, I do want to find out about myself. I do want to know why people are so different from each other. And maybe there are methods that you can actually do that go beyond, say, reading a novel or a biography or, you know, delving into history. So I got hooked, but it was quite gradual. I signed up for, you know, workshops and seminars and lectures. And I think the lectures that really, really made, you know, gave me the sort of no turning back point were case demonstrations in psychiatry. So there was a professor who was pretty well known for his ability to interview patients from the psychiatric hospital, university hospital, with their consent, of course, in front of students. And the cases he presented were, to me, of tremendous fascination. And I remember quite a lot of details about them. I remember thinking that this is so incredibly important. We didn't seem to have any answers, not even perhaps very good questions, but some questions to begin with. And that turned me into, you know, interest in clinical psychology, because it seemed to me that through really getting deeper into these puzzling phenomena that you could see in patients with a mental illness, you might get to find out more about the, you know, normal mind.
Receiving her PhD from King's College London in 1968, Uta first turned her attention as a researcher to understanding the development of reading and spelling in the context of dyslexia.
Yes, I was interested in how children learn to read. And that was already in Germany when I, you know, did some projects that we had to do for our degree. And I really found out that there are these big individual differences. Some children found it very easy, and other children who seemed to me to be equally intelligent and eager to learn and well-behaved, couldn't. Again, one of those puzzles to me. I said, what's going on? What can we study about that? And I think I was first interested in reading as a sort of visual, perceptual activity. And then I came to see that it's actually much more to do with spoken language, with language, of course, and that there might be something subtly different, subtly wrong in the way that some children process the sound of speech. And that, you know, processing sound of speech is absolutely vital for the use of the alphabet, because the alphabet is a translation of sound of speech, except it cuts up the sound of speech in a totally weird, artificial way, in little sounds that don't actually exist, like k, t. How can you make cat out of that? It's just ridiculous. But we're all convinced after we learn the alphabet that k, t, spoken together, fast, makes cat. So, you know, it's a complete illusion. It's not like that. But you have to get to these little bits of sound in order to map them to the letters of the alphabet. And it's there where we have a bottleneck, so that some children really can't get easily to that step. They take a long time to understand it. And they probably have some sort of different ways of getting to it and learning it. I was extremely interested. And I think it is one of those neurodevelopmental disorders that, you know, seem on the surface like possibly a little problem. Maybe you could find out, you know, really what to do about it. And that would be it. problem solved, but it's not like that at all. We are still asking the same questions. We're still finding out whether there are children, yes, indeed, who have these sound processing difficulties, and other children who may indeed have some more visual problems or some other reason for not learning so fast as other children.
Even though Uta continued to explore phenomena like dyslexia for much of her career, it was another neurodevelopmental disorder that she would become best known for. I asked Uta whether autism, as reported elsewhere, is indeed an obsession of hers.
I think you're absolutely right. It is an obsession. And the reason that I believe this is because after 50 years of really being preoccupied with it, I'm still amazed and fascinated every time. So to keep it that long and not be frustrated by not making faster progress or perhaps bored by, you know, hearing the same stories again, that is sort of like a sign of some kind of intellectual obsession.
But how and where did that take hold? Because it's very different from dyslexia. So how did you move from the one into the other?
To me, you know, there are a lot of similarities because we are talking about neurodevelopmental disorders. So something to do with the brain, that's the neuro part, and development is really the critical feature for both. So there might be something wrong to begin with for genetic reasons of one kind or another, interacting in some way, setting the development in motion on a different path in both cases. And of course, you have no choice what's going to happen. But they both tell us something about the development of the mind. How it can go wrong will tell us about how it does normally go right.
When you started looking at autism, the general belief was that this was sort of caused by refrigerator mothers, was a sort of term that was going around. Did you question that from the start, the fact, you know, cold parenting might be behind it?
I think I did question it from the start because it was part of my kind of rebellion against psychoanalysis, which of course I had read, familiarized myself with, but it was quite clear that this wasn't a science. It wasn't like finding empirical evidence, testing it, going in another direction if it didn't turn out. It was completely self-contained. And all there was at the time to understand autism were sort of psychoanalytic ideas. And they had very much to do, I thought, and I still think, with an idea that you could blame parents or something in the relationship between children and parents. And that seemed to me really not only wrong, but also harmful. Straight away from meeting mothers of autistic children, I could see that they were just like other mothers. And also, of course, they had other children who were not autistic. Now, psychoanalysts, of course, because it's not a science, can explain everything post hoc. And they were not deterred. And it was very difficult, actually, to have a different stance because at the time there was no way to identify a brain abnormality. There were no data on that. There were even no data on genetic factors. But that soon changed. It changed in the 1970s. And I remember that that was a great relief. I've always strove for finding evidence, direct evidence of some kind of brain abnormality. And, well, in the late 80s and the scanners became available, we could, as it were, look at the brain structure and brain function. And as soon as it was possible, I think almost as soon as they appeared, we said, right, we must get the autistic people in the scanner and see what's going wrong. Now, again, it turned out, wow, there was no simple answer. These instruments are really very, very crude. And to see an abnormality, you know, which I really was hoping for, you know, like a hole or something like that. That was just so naive. And it's not like that because, you know, we are talking about developmental processes that take many different routes. And the brain is so complex and the relationship between brain and mind is so unknown as yet that we can't actually answer that. So that still sort of both frustrates me and excites me. It's sort of like saying, oh, I wish there was a breakthrough in this technology that we can see further, see better. You know, a bit like the astronomers who first relied on pretty poor telescopes and so on. They could see more than the naked eye, and it was exciting. But, you know, not seeing something doesn't mean it's not there. And that's where we need to get better technology.
Whilst this brain imaging technology is still developing, and with it our understanding of autism, insights into the inner workings of the minds of autistic children took a definitive turn in 1985, with Frith and Baron Cohen's Sally Ann experiments designed to examine the role of theory of mind.
Does the autistic child have a theory of mind?
But what exactly is theory of mind?
I now briefly describe it as a sat-nav for social world, as opposed to having a map, which is very cumbersome to read. So it's a special sense that allows us to track mental states in other people. Now, what are mental states? They are beliefs and desires and intentions and knowledge. And we do that spontaneously and unconsciously. It's no trouble at all. We just take account of what other people are thinking or wanting to do. And that spontaneous ability is what we believe is missing in people with autism.
There's an experiment you did called the Sally Ann experiment, I think, which is a real classic. Can you talk me through what that was all about?
Yeah, that experiment was done by Simon Baron Cohen, who was my PhD student at the time. And it was just like the biggest surprise for me to find that in such a simple task, you find quite intelligent children failing.
First of all, the child has to establish the fact that their own belief is false. Then they have to put themselves inside the mind of another child in order to predict that child's beliefs.
So let me describe the task, because it is simple, deceptively simple perhaps. It was first done with two dolls, Sally and Anne, but you can use real people, makes no difference. So Sally has a basket, Anne has a box, and Sally has a marble that she puts into her basket. And Sally then leaves the room, goes out to play. Now, meanwhile, naughty Anne takes the marble out of the basket and puts it into her own box, puts the lid on. Now Sally comes back and she wants to play with her marble. Where's she going to look? And most 4 or 5 year old children will immediately say she will look in the basket, or they will point to the basket, because of course that's where Sally believes the marble is. She wasn't there when it was put into a different location. But autistic children pointed to where the marble really was, because for them, reality, as it were, trumps what's in somebody else's mind. And it's that difference which was really so beautifully demonstrated with this task.
Like many children of this age, when asked what another child will think, Elizabeth simply projects what she now believes herself about the tube of sweets. She doesn't recognise that the other child exists as an independent thinking being. And presented with another task of this kind, she acts in much the same way.
A seminal paper within the field of autism research, Frith and Baron Cohen's conclusions would go on to change our views of the autistic mind. After this short break, we'll explore that further.
From being an incredibly believed rare condition that most people never heard of and thought they would never ever meet anybody like that, it has become a household name. That's been a huge change.
We'll also hear about Uta Frith, the mentor.
sometimes I believe you actually need a rebellion. You need a generation change just so that you get innovation.
We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Jason Phipps here, ruler of all things podcast here at The Guardian. Just to let you know that this episode is sponsored by the good people at Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Before we kick off again, I want to point you in the direction of a new podcast by the Guardian team. Called Brexit Means, it's an in-depth look at Brexit, hosted by the Guardian's European Affairs correspondent, John Henley. So far, the podcast has looked at what Brexit means in light of the Supreme Court decision on triggering Article 50. What it means for EU citizens living in the UK, and in the most recent episode, what it means for the UK's financial services sector. To subscribe to Brexit Means, head to theguardian.com/podcasts or get it on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Nicola Davis. Before the break, we heard from Professor Uta Frith about her career within research of neurodevelopmental disorders, including dyslexia and autism. Something I wanted to talk about is how we diagnose autism and the impact that's had.
There's been a huge increase in the number of individuals diagnosed with autism in recent years, and many theories as well surrounding why that might be. What do you think is driving the trend? What's going on here? It's been a sort of perennial question, really.
It surprises me that people find that so difficult to explain, because to me, it's obvious. We have changed our criteria. We have widened the criteria. So in other words, there are many, many more people who always existed, but they're now called autistic. They're not diagnosed as autistic. We have this spectrum of autism, which is so wide that, of course, the numbers are bigger. And then, of course, previously, when I started, we ever only knew about autistic children. And you know that every child grows up to be an adult. And we have many more adults than we have children. And in the adult population, of course, people were diagnosed when they had not previously been diagnosed as children. So there are many really quite obvious, you could even say boring reasons why the numbers increased. They had to increase. I know people just won't take this as a good answer, because it's sort of, again, perhaps a tendency to say, what if they've really increased? What if more children were born than before with autism? Then we would have to do something about it. And there are all sorts of scare stories. But it's not necessary to think that. I think it's absolutely possible to explain the increase just by these changes in our diagnostic procedures and in the criteria that are being used.
Over the course of your career, our understanding of autism has expanded hugely. What are the biggest changes you've seen in not just scientific but also societal attitudes towards autism?
From being an incredibly believed rare condition that most people never heard of and thought they would never ever meet anybody like that, it has become a household name. That's been a huge change. I think when I first started, it was really an idea that it would only affect children who had a very, very severe learning disability at the same time. Also, it was very difficult to disentangle the intellectual disability with, for example, the savant skills that 10% or even 30% of the autistic children seem to show. Now, we had realized, but very, very gradually, that the intellectual disability is not a necessary concomitant of autism. You can have autism without intellectual disability. So this was an explosion in a way, thinking, we have to look at this completely differently. The next thing was, beginning, we only saw children. What would happen when they grew up? We asked this question. We thought, you know, they must be there somewhere, or are they going to be suddenly cured? Of course, we couldn't imagine that. And then we became aware what it meant to be autistic and adult. So this was a huge revelation. And it was, you know, for me, a very, very satisfying to be able to see something about the whole developmental course, what's going on. And by the way, aging is like a new frontier in this whole area. That's where research actually is happening now. You know, what does aging mean when you are autistic? We know what happens in adulthood now, but not so much at later ages. So yes, all of these are enormous changes. I think also there's been this change from being really rather enclosed in this idea that it's psychogenic, that it's nothing to do with the brain. Thank God we've shed all that and found out that, you know, brain and mind, two sides of the same coin. There must be something different, abnormal in the brain very early on to take such a very different path through development. So everybody, I think, assumes that there is a biological basis.
There's been a lot of discussion about the genetics behind autism. It feels like, you know, every other week there's another story saying they found more genes that are linked to autism. Do you think that people are over-focusing on the genetic side, or do you think that is, you know, really where the nub of this comes back to, or how do you feel about that?
I think we do need to unravel the genetic risk factors. I'm very glad that this research is being done, and it does seem that more and more and more cases can be attributed to particular genetic factors. It's very, very exciting, but we are all not quite, I think, we're not quite sure about how genetic risk factors actually influence mental development. So it's very much a search in the dark.
Looking forward to the future of research in autism, what are you most excited about? Because it's a field that excites you so much. There must be particular things that you think are going to be big, big issues.
I'm still most interested in the mind of the autistic person. Although I think that the research effort, you know, if you think of the proportion of research, is really concentrated on the biological factors, the genetic risk factors. And of course also what's happening in the brain, the connections, the disconnections, and all sorts of ideas about what might be different in the brain of the autistic person. But what I'm really excited about is hearing more, learning more about what effect this has on the developing mind, and how it is possible that so many autistic people find coping strategies, ways around their problems, and are able to lead really good and happy lives.
Within the world of autism research, this excitement, passion, and curiosity has catapulted Uta Frith to a position of much-deserved seniority, something Uta has previously claimed came, in part, from her mentors, which included Neil O'Connor and Beata Hermelin, fellow pioneers in her field of research. In turn, Uta has mentored the likes of Simon Baron-Cohen, Maggie Snowling, the current president of St John's College, Oxford, and Francesca Happe, director of the MRC Social, Genetic and Developmental Psychiatry Centre at King's College London. I asked Uta how important mentors are within the world of science.
Hugely important, we all know that, but we don't yet know what really good mentoring means. I don't think there will be a general prescription that fits all. So I think, for example, from what I learned from my own mentors and how I probably behaved towards people I mentored, I very much stressed independence. You do need not just to be like a parent, protective and wanting to be, you know exactly what they're doing, what they're planning. You need to really let go. And I think in mentoring programs, that's not necessarily always emphasized. I think the idea that of independence is very often emphasized in these programs. But sometimes I believe you actually need rebellion. You need a generation change just so that you get innovation and new ideas. So I think I have had a bit of a rebellious streak, which I don't know where it comes from, but it made me question things that people might have said, well, how can you do that? And I hope that the same thing happened in people that I mentored, and I hope they do that with their students.
You are also a strong advocate for women in science. In fact, I think we first met at a Women in Science event. What needs to be done to encourage women into the field, but also to stay in science?
I believe that there have been some very positive changes about making sure that girls know that science is for them as well, and they can do it, and then they can get confidence. Of course, we have to start early while they're still at school, that they know that they can be interested in topics that even they may think, because of all our cultural stereotypes, are not for them. You know, the idea of science, not for me, I might do something else. And I'm very keen on the idea that everybody should be given a second chance. So think of me, I was perfectly ready to have a sort of arts, humanities career. And it was possible for me to take another one into the science field. And I would like that to be possible for everyone, and for everyone to think that they could do that. So yes, that's how to get women into a science career. Now the question about how to keep them there. And I think that is actually quite an interesting question. And it has to do with perhaps creating more science-related jobs in general, or greater awareness of which jobs exist that are very heavy on science. So we love to have, you know, people who are knowledgeable about science in almost all areas, including the arts. Because you need to have a critical mind, which is what science makes absolutely essential. You need to have a meticulous attention to detail. You need to do all sorts of things that I think will benefit society. And we haven't sort of quite made clear that staying in science isn't just about getting research grants and having this ridiculously insecure life that you can have at universities, but that perhaps you can hang on to science once you've started such a career in many different ways of life.
Special thanks this week to Uta Frith. We'll include a link to Uta's wonderful book, Autism, A Very Short Introduction, in the episode's description on the Guardian website. Do check it out. I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.